What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump, and it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show, and the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners, and if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter. It'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and on the mic remotely, we've got Gabby Magnuson, Kiara Mitchell, Jake Dello. We were just talking about how there's so much going on, our heads are exploding, but I also feel like we say that every week. So
yeah, that's true.
Maybe
we've
just
watered it down a bit, haven't we?
Yeah, so we're going to give you some of the most important points, I guess, but a couple news items and then a couple shout-outs. On news items, South Korea held parliamentary elections, and President Moon's party, Minjudong, the Democratic Party, won parliamentary seats in a landslide. I don't have numbers because I'm not prepared, but the Democrats won big, and the only like real conservative surprise win, if you can call it that, although it's maybe not a surprise, a North Korean defector who was a senior official named Tae Young-ho, he won a seat in the National Assembly, and wow. his district is Gangnam, from like the Gangnam style music, sensation, cliche, whatever. And it's famously the ritziest district in Seoul, very cosmopolitan. And Tae Young-ho has become this big name kind of celebrity, policy celebrity, if there's such a thing in Korea. People listen to him like nobody else when it comes to like understanding the North Korean mind and that kind of thing. And so he's also very kind of famous in the West when it comes to thinking about Kim Jong-un and North Korea policy. He won this seat despite being conservative. And I have to think that it's because of his celebrity when so many other conservatives just didn't do that great. But regardless, the Democratic Party winning a majority in the parliament means that President Moon in South Korea is not going to be a lame duck. It's his way or the highway to a large extent. And this ends up having huge implications for regional security strategy. This is something I tweeted on a couple days ago, maybe, that even Asia hands kind of struggle to appreciate how important the domestic politics of ally countries are for the different ways that we have to deter, to reassure, like our strategy as in U.S. strategy, it's what will work, especially on allies. It depends very much on how the allies, you know, perceive things, their threat perceptions, their beliefs, their preferences. And the liberals, progressives in South Korea, the left, is of a particular mind on North Korea that is not reassured by nuclear bomber deployments, that is not reassured by like over-the-top threats. They're reassured by like arms control and stable negotiations and predictability. And that's a little bit different from where the Japanese government's at right now, which creates a tension for the United States. But it means that like the ability... I think there was people in Washington who thought that like you could wait out the Moon administration on North Korea and just get back to like maximum pressure and denuclearization as soon as Moon was a lame duck.
Not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore.
I had a conversation with Gary
prior a couple of days ago in regards to this, and she kind of pointed out to me that the left and right in South Korea aren't really what we would consider left and right here. So how left is the incumbent government? How left wing are they?
Well, how left is Confucian culture going to be? Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Fucking.
Yeah,
okay. They're, okay. It's two versions of the right wing. Like, they're pretty conservative society. And so there's actually been not a a lot of bridge building between the South Korean left and the American left. They have very, very little in common, except that they both have a kind of dovish approach to North Korea for the most part.
And is that because they border them? And they're the first target?
It's weird. North Korea is like a defining issue in South Korean politics. So it's like a very good indicator. What you think about North Korea is a good predictor of which party you belong to in South Korea. And yeah, it's not that important.
Okay. That makes sense. It's different, I guess, because a lot of other states don't have... technically, they're at war, right? So they don't have a warring state on their border with weapons pointed directly at them. So I can... completely understand why North Korea is probably the defining point in politics.
I mean, and in my recent book, one of the arguments I made, or one of the strands of my argument, was that had the left not been in the presidency when that crisis broke in Korea in 2017, there would have been no real off-ramp available from the crisis. And so that's an example where it's, I mean, who was in charge? It's the difference between war and peace in that instance. Because Kim Jong-un needed an olive branch from South Korea to climb down from the Russian roulette nuclear style that Trump and Kim Jong-un were in at the time. And so all of that stuff went Kim Jong-un's way, but the necessary precursor to Kim Jong-un summit diplomacy was Moon Jae-in kind of reaching out his hand to take a more cooperative path, even though North Korea has kind of forsaken the South since then. But the South Korean left is just adamant about the kind of engagement approach that Moon prefers. That is also not where Washington is. So like, that's more friction within the U.S.-South Korea alliance at a time when you don't need a lot of friction.
Yeah, exactly.
There's enough to go around.
Needed, right?
Yeah. Other news, Chicago Council on Global Affairs. We give them shout outs whenever they do shit because it's good shit. They just released a new poll on it covered millennial attitudes about China. It covered a lot of stuff, but that's like the part that's of interest.
That's interesting, following their last one that we covered, which was, from my memory, millennials about American exceptionalism.
That's right. They're looking at generational divides on foreign policy issue, and they're one of the issues, and they're one of the only ones who actually does do that.
I assume they're not lumping Gen Z in with millennials with that.
So that's my main critique. And we said this last episode, and the big fat didn't listen to us. So Chicago Council, fucking guys, break out millennials and Gen Z. That's one of the things they did not do this time. And I think it's super consequential.
Is it a case of you not wanting to be with us, or us not wanting to be with you?
Shots fired.
Maybe there's different levels of knowledge.
Yeah, right.
Also, okay. People who are 15, 16, even 10-year-olds are considered Gen Z, and it's weird.
Yeah. And so I think the cutoff for millennial is 25.
Yeah, 1996 or 1995.
Jesus.
Well, in that case, I'm just on the cutoff. So I can
be
both.
Yeah, same. It's whack.
I can be both.
Yeah. I mean, there are times when it's like we're all the same, but then there are issues like Transformers where we end up in different places for hip-hop.
I think I was talking to a bunch of, what's it called, like 50, 60-year-olds, and I think they just assume millennials were going to be like in their 20s forever. Mm. I think it's kind of like we all somehow blended into that.
Yeah. The reason this Chicago Council thing was interesting or important, possibly what brought it about, was that there's like conventional wisdom in China policy and in Washington that millennials are more hawkish than boomers on China. And like a lot of people were saying that for quite a while. And the survey doesn't fully illuminate this question because of like the way the questions were asked and structured, but the results kind of challenged that conventional wisdom a little bit. It showed boomers as, so their question was like, the rise of China, U.S. foreign policy in Asia, in dealing with the rise of China's power, do you think the U.S. should? And then it was like basically cooperation or containment. Yeah. And then there was a question about allies. So you stick with them or, you know, forsake them. And everybody across all demographics, majorities, supported alliances in the same percentage. So all about, you know, 66-65% support for allies. So that's good.
Is that surprising?
Not really.
It's not to me. Like,
yeah.
I can understand why everyone wants allies.
And what I saw a friend of mine say is like, well, you know, millennials just want to give everybody hugs. So like, they're not going to burn the allies because allies are friends, but they also don't want to, you know, get in a fight. So they want to be friends with the enemy. And so like, that's a very simplistic way to put it. And
yeah,
I'm probably not right, but it's convenient. But the on the question of like, do you take a more cooperative or competitive approach to China? Millennials skewed toward favoring like kind of an engagement approach, more so than any other generation. And the boomers were the most hawkish on China.
Yeah.
So, or no, I'm sorry, Gen X was the most hawkish on China, actually.
Oh, okay.
Followed by boomers, which is weird because Gen X is like, they don't care about anything. Why? it's like Fight Club. So... I don't know. Like,
you broke the first rule, man.
That's right.
You don't talk about Fight Club.
You don't talk about polling. So I don't know. So this is, it's super, there's a lot to unpack here. And it's like each one of these surveys that they do, it's an interesting data point. It mostly matters in relation to asking the same questions kind of over time.
Yeah.
I suspect post-pandemic, you ask some of these questions and the anti-Chinese sentiment will probably be higher. Just overall, it's the whole reason this is interesting is because of this. It kind of pushes back, but not definitively, on this conventional wisdom that millennials are more hawkish than boomers. And the one caveat I would put to all of this is that, like, in my experience, Washington DC millennials tend to be much more hawkish than fucking everybody except like neocons.
That's a very niche group.
They select into that.
Mm.
Technically, it's like where I come from, but like elder millennial from Washington. But I don't know. It's interesting data points. Good shout out.
Really interesting.
Yeah. And then two other quick shout outs. One is to Kelsey Atherton, who's I don't know what his right title is. He's a journalist who's also kind of like an ardent leftist, and he edits a blog on left foreign policy called Fellow Travelers. It's like, it's pretty left, definitely left of center. They're a little hostile to liberals, but there's also like a lot of good stuff there. And he wrote a piece at slate.com about how cyberpunk as a genre in the 80s was like responsive. It was a response to neoliberalism and like all the deregulatory trend of the 80s with like Thatcher and Reagan. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And like that actually makes a ton of sense. I never really thought of it like that. And all those science fiction worlds that were painted in the 80s, they were like this dystopia where there was no government unless it was like the security state coming in to get you or something. But
your libertarian fever dream.
Yeah. And so otherwise there was no government. It was, you know, monopolies and corporations ran everything. The law was corrupted. That's like a theme that comes out of all of this genre. And it's just like an amazingly good read. I'm going to try to get him on the show, but I'll link to this piece in the show notes because it's just like cyberpunk has a feel to it that's like gritty and cool and like Japanese, you know, neon signs. There's something like, it's very like, it evokes certain emotions that are very edgy and hip. And we're living it now, right? Basically. And so, who knew? It feels less surprised. Like when you think about it like that, it's like, fuck, we are in dystopia, but we just sort of like migrated into it without realizing it or something. So it's very insightful.
kind of wish we were leaning more into the solar punk aspect as opposed to like the cyberpunk kind of deal. I mean, aesthetically, it's like cool, but
solo punk? Like, what? Oh,
it's kind of scary.
Solo punk. I've never heard of that.
I don't even know what you're talking about, dude.
You guys this don't is, know again, that?
Gen Z.
Oh, sorry. I played too many video games.
Yeah, I'm into the intersection. That's why I worked on that Star Wars book with. Oh, incidentally, Kelsey Atherton authored a chapter in that same Star Wars book. So there we go.
Hold on. You worked on a Star Wars book?
Yeah. So there's a book called Strategy Strikes Back a couple years ago, and I wrote a chapter in the book. It was like a compilation book. It's pretty good.
Like, how did you get Sulu wrong then? Last week you were like Star Wars.
I didn't get it wrong. It was like a verbal slip. but you guys pounced on it.
I found the book and I just found your chapter, and it's like the why the Galactic Republic fell, and it's like, oh yeah, I have opinions on it as well. I'm very anti the Jedi because they kidnapped children from their parent. I have opinions.
So the Jedi before the Republic fell was problematic. Yeah. Jedi as rebels were, I don't know.
Jedi rebels were better, but the Jedi before the Republic fell were problematic. They kidnapped children from their parents. And then people complained about the first one doing so. I was like, who did they get that idea from?
So the Jedi before the Republic fell, this is like quite a tangent, but the like this is what my chapter's on too, because like my argument is that basically the Republic was structured as an empire when it was still a republic. And so all it took was one asshole to come in and make a few changes, and it didn't take much because the structure was already there. And the you know, reading between the lines warning was like, look, America is also structured as an empire, and if we're not, it's not going to take much to show that the emperor has no clothes here. And so, like, there's a danger in deluding yourself into thinking you're a republic when you're a republican name only kind of thing.
Yeah.
But where are the Ewoks? They are the best character in the Star Wars franchise.
Jar Jar Binks is obviously the best character.
Yeah, hard. Yeah. I'll die on that hill. He's a legend. That was the first one I ever saw. He looked like Jar Jar Binks. Was my bro. He was a fucking legend.
Oh, man.
You guys, I'm less militant about this than people of my generation, but if anybody my age hears you say that fucking Jar Jar Binks was cool, or like any, or the fucking even the Ewoks, they'll like lose their shit. People think those characters are like super annoying. I don't.
Yeah, they are.
I don't care.
I like Boba Fett. That's who I like.
I guess you guys just
it's
hate
sarcasm.
Fun.
Yeah.
I guess you guys just don't like fun.
Oh, that's why. Next segment.
I
next
like
segment.
Dominating the world.
Okay, last, before we get to the rest of the segments, Senator Chris Murphy, who is leading foreign policy voice in Congress, Democrat, there's a profile of him written in Vox by Alex Ward, who's a buddy of mine, journalist, and the profile is amazing. And what you see coming through in the piece, in the interviews, is what I've understood of him for a while now. He is one of like the leading intellectuals on foreign policy in government and Congress, but in the Democratic Party for sure. Like, he's the person in Congress who is most like Bernie and Elizabeth Warren on foreign policy. Because like the Justice Democrats and AOC and stuff, like even Ro Khanna, they share certain aspects of the worldview with Bernie, but they're also, I think, in many ways to the left of Bernie on foreign policy. And Chris Murphy is kind of like navigating this genuine third way, not like a liberal Democrat thing, but like something that's more progressive than that, but is obviously also not fucking orthodox Marxist, right? And not that there's anything wrong with that. But he's about like, just I'll link to this in show notes too, hopefully, although often when I say that I don't actually do it. He said in the interview, like, quote, I'm 100% sure that I'm right about how badly positioned America is in the world today. I'm 100% sure this world cannot become a better place unless the United States is an active force for good. I'm 100% sure that the foreign policy consensus in Washington has made us less safe. I'm 100% sure that the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us against has become the very nightmare he he envisioned. And that is like emblematic of what I've seen from his foreign policy views. I think I've mentioned it. I'm working on a book on progressive foreign policy. And he's triangulating something here. Like, this is way, he's rejecting the center. He's rejecting establishment Democrat foreign policy positions. Yeah. And yet he's also not like just raw anti-imperialist, right? He's not, he's like a constructive critic of US power, and he's in a position to do something about it. And so this is interesting. I'm just flagging this to keep an eye out for this guy.
Yeah.
He could easily run for president if he can triangulate domestic politics the way he's triangulating foreign policy. So shout out to the Chris Murphy doctrine. I don't know.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, for Prediction Market this week, we're going to go straight to the United States. Will the United States reinstate World Health Organization funding before August?
I'm going to say no. And if you haven't seen the news, this has been like a multiple week story now, but Trump has officially decided to put a hold on World Health Organization funding pending a review. Yeah. It's not like you need a pandemic response institution at the time of a pandemic. It's maddening. We talked about this last week. I also think there's, on staff Twitter, this is going to come up again. There was actually like a little bit of a pissing contest on social media among people, even on the left, about continuing to fund the WHO, the World Health Organization, at a time when they're kowtowing to China, when they're you know, blocking Taiwan and pretending like Taiwan doesn't exist, basically. So this is it's a strategic question whether you keep funding them or not, mostly. Like, there is maybe a principled question or moral question, but like the foremost issue is strategic. It's bad strategy to when you cut off your own funding and your own participation, you lose influence. Yeah. If that's the thing you care about most, then the last thing you should be doing is cutting off funding. But we may talk about this again later in the show.
A few weeks ago, we gave Van a prediction on whether the Russo-Saudi oil war will escalate. He said, yes, it would. And he was right, funnily enough. It did.
Funnily enough. Question,
yeah. Who knew?
Okay.
No shots fired, man. No shots fired. But will we see an end to the Russo-Saudi oil war before July?
I don't think so, no. And the main reason I think that is because the competition between Russia and Saudi Arabia is the result of reduced global demand for oil. And it just seems like there's going to continue to be downward pressure on oil, probably for like another year. I mean, for a while. So I'm going to say things get worse before they get better.
That's unfortunate. But question three, will there be an official cessation of conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia before August?
So I did not see these questions before coming into the show.
you should probably start reading them.
Motherfucker.
Because these are just going to keep coming up.
It's been very busy. Very busy in the household. I have not honestly been tracking this conflict recently, but back in the day, I actually did used to track it, and it's a long story why. Mm. I don't see a conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia ending anytime soon, but a cessation of hostilities or a ceasefire amid a pandemic is plausible. There are logical incentives for it. So I'm going to be an optimist and say yes, with the caveat that, like, who fucking knows?
Well, I would have held the same position as you, Van, but after reading the article I did, and, well, it wasn't really an article. I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, but it was a Reddit post. But it was on a subreddit called Geopolitics, which I recommend anyone interested in it to go look at. It's very professionally run. It's essentially curated so that the most credible questions get posed, and it's like essentially a good talking arena.
Is it run by the FSB?
No, I'm yet to be an admin, so I can't really start censoring people yet. But they mentioned that the only real way for Armenia and Azerbaijan to combat COVID-19 effectively would be to have a cessation of conflict and just work together just for this, you know, like Azerbaijan removing its restrictions on Armenian citizens and vice versa. Mm. It's the only way they're going to be able to combat COVID-19 without essentially destroying both of their countries.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But that's like it's the whole like alien invasion unites the planet kind of thing. Like the pandemic is supposed to be the alien invasion here. And what we're seeing is like repeated failures of collective action, repeated failures of multilateral institutions, or at least shortcomings. And so the world is like not so far coming together the way that like a liberal would hope.
Time for Say of Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
So the first tweet I found for this week is in reference to the Guardian article that relays the condemnation of the decision made by the Trump administration to freeze funding for the World Health Organization. For this article, Stephen Maher tweets, "A flawed World Health Organization is 100 times better than no World Health Organization. Nobody else can do its vital work. Other countries will have to fill the funding gap." So I wanted to bring this tweet up because of two reasons. So the first, as we touched upon last week, is that, well, at least I think he makes a good point. I know the WHO isn't exactly 100% perfect, and we know that, but I thought it was generally understood that we were better off having it. And I suppose the second reason was because I wanted Van to weigh in on what will happen in that funding vacuum. I know that Ireland, like in the last 24 hours, has stepped up and contributed like quadruple their funding, and that the Bill Gates Foundation has put up like $150 million as well. Mm. So.
Yeah, others will fill the void. One of the listeners to the pod, friends of the pod, Gerard Diaz, also like had this huge tweet thread about like all this stuff the EU is doing in member states of the EU that they're doing too. It's sort of all filling a void, but it's not preventing China from exercising greater influence. And the withdrawal of the U.S. or the informal withdrawal of the U.S. by withholding funds, the U.S. cutting itself off from influence de facto gives China more influence. And like seriously, within 24 hours of Trump announcing the withholding of funds, China condemned the U.S. for being like isolationist and promised that they would like redouble their efforts to invest in the World Health Organization. So of course, like China becomes more and more central, and China probably won't make up all the shortfall of the United States funding, because I think the US provided like way more funding than the Chinese. But when you add Chinese funding to like Bill Gates and other organizations, Ireland, the WHO's going to be fine. The world's not going to be fine. And the world, especially if the WHO is in China's pocket, like nobody benefits from that structurally in the long term. So that's the concern here. It's like the US is making decisions that are kind of lose-lose for everybody.
Yeah, it just seems the end goal, well, not the end goal, but the end result, the only real thing that happens is that the United States loses another ally.
Yeah, awesome. Fucking great own goal, guys.
yeah.
So I had one tweet this week. Two buddies of mine, actually, there's like lots of buddies of mine in this. Eric Gomez, who runs like the defense policy side of the Cato Institute, DC think tank. He says, "Very excited to meet all of these new Chinese nuclear experts on Twitter.com today. Why didn't y'all come to any of the get-togethers all these years? We're a fun group." And then Ken Schultz, who's also a buddy, who's a professor at Stanford, he responded, "You should be patient with them. After all, they've spent the last few weeks being epidemiology experts." And then Bob Kelly, BBC dad, piled on top of this and he goes, "Yes, these are the same people who a few weeks ago were experts on Chinese wet markets, North Korea nuclear weapons before that, and Islam after 9/11. Fox is like a polymathic education right over the TV." And aside from like having good comedic timing, what they're talking about, like the underlying issue here, is that Tom Cotton's Uber Hawk senator and a bunch of Uber Hawks in the GOP are fueling the fires of like very ethno-nationalist styled rivalry with China, or like ethno-nationalist approach to China. And Tom Cotton, motherfucker, he wrote in the, I think it was USA Today, an op-ed that literally said, "We need to quarantine China from the civilized world."
Oh, wow.
It's dripping with clash of civilizations, overtones, undertones, tone, Tones, I don't know. And
what article was this? What publication?
I think it was in USA Today, which is like a very, it's like, oh, it's, shit. It's written at like a sixth grade level, but it's very pop. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's why it's wide reaching. And so it's hitting mass audience and he's owning it. Like, it's not like a tweet where you're sitting on the toilet and like you just had a thought bubble. It's like you crafted this. You know, like, it takes a while to sit down and write an op-ed, or even if you're having your staff do it, you're having to like approve it, you know? So this is real. And it is the like ethno-nationalist emphasis rhetoric to support the larger decoupling project. And it's basically calling for like containment of China from the world, you know? I think China's a bad guy. I don't think that's much of a solution.
Yeah. Well, it's the unfortunate thing is now there is no, well, there wasn't before, but now there especially is no good guy, you know, because China does the same thing. China are remarkably ethno-nationalist, and now the United States is doing it. It's, you know, now
mirror imaging them is not going to get us anywhere. Yeah.
No, and no, there's no good guy anymore. Like, even the US press, there's no, you can't put that on a national publication.
Yeah. And so now Tom Cotton and all these fucking China hawk clash of civilization fucks, they are accusing China of conducting nuclear tests in violation of the CTBT, Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And neither the US nor China has ratified this agreement, but they've both abided by it. And so, like, it's, and so Tom Cotton and everybody else, all these fucking China guys, they're all like, well, we need to unsign that or reverse sign that. And despite having not ratified it, it's basically saying the US should now be free to test nuclear weapons at will because China is also. And it's like, what do you benefit from doing that? Like, once again, it's like you're just killing arms control norms. Like, you're killing the regime by killing individual treaties and by killing practices and norms that exist on top of the treaties, you know, or beside the treaties. And so it's just literally decisions that make the world more dangerous. And so all these China hawks saying this shit, they're all basing it on analytical claims about what China is or is not doing in underground testing facilities and all this shit. And there are arms control experts like Jeffrey Lewis, the Middlebury Institute in Monterey, like Eric Gomez, like fucking Ankit Panda, all these guys who watch this stuff for a living, who do not think that China is in violation of the CTBT right now. And even if they are in violation of like the spirit of it, there's a second order question about whether that means we should also start testing nukes. Is this a practice we want to reinstantiate into the world, right? Are we like North Korea now? So that's what Eric Gomez is talking about, because like most of the experts on nuclear shit disagree with the China hawks on the analysis of what's actually happening. And so this is I faced this in the North Korean nuclear crisis in 2017. Yeah. Everybody's a fucking expert, right? So,
well, do the China hawks realize that they started the breakdown of this process by putting in low-yield nuclear weapons months ago?
No, they don't
The breakdown of the nuclear trust that was there, they started the breakdown of that?
Yeah, no, they don't. And it's part of the reason why you could never convince them to take responsibilities, because they're just wildly irresponsible. Okay. But also because, like, you can't prove stuff like that unless you have some, like, smoking gun cable coming out of Beijing that secretly says, hey, in order to spite the American counter move, we're going to do this. And you can't get that level of, like, smoking gun evidence, you know? Anyway, shout out to the tweets.
It's really tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's bad. It's real bad. This is, if Trump wins re-election, or if he loses re-election but stays in office, we're all in, like, a lot of trouble, because he's been stripping away through every decision gradually all these like pillars of stability in the world. And no single pillar of stability is the thing that holds up global order, but global order was constituted of all of it collectively. And as you whittle it down and whittle it down, you're creating more and more space for miscalculations. You're creating more and more pressures toward conflict. It's a very dangerous world. And getting somebody, even like Biden, would just somebody who's rational, would restore a lot of those pillars, you know, maybe they all shouldn't be restored, but like get us back to an even keel and
just reestablish the trust.
Something. That's the key. Something. Something other than like overt hostility to the whole world.
Well, the fact that it wasn't ratified by either country proves that it was literally just trust. That it was literally just a trust that you're not going to do it, I'm not going to do it.
US and Hungary are going to form their own NATO.
Oh, God.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, God.
I'm just kidding. They fucking better not.
No, that's a fucking dystopia, man. Yeah. No, that's a fucking dystopia.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
So for this week, we actually had two different analyses to look at. It'll be really quickly. This first one is an article from The New Republic titled "Don't Fear the Anti-Biden Socialist." And this article talks about a wave of concern over the DSA's refusal to endorse the Democratic nominee and about the ignorance about who does and does not vote and why.
DSA is Democratic Socialists of America, for anyone who doesn't know.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry. Cool. And so basically, it's because, as we know by now, Bernie Sanders had endorsed Joe Biden for the presidency. Over the last several days, a number of Sanders backing groups, including Campus Outpost for the Sanders campaign, local chapters of the DSA and the National DSA organization itself, tweeted their refusals to support Joe Biden. And Noah Nevu, who's the writer, talks about the wisdom of opting out, of not bucking up, lowering our standards and thresholds, and choosing the lesser of two evils. They basically point out that since 2016, there's been this weird conviction among political commentators that jilted young Sanders supporters who might not turn out are one of the most critical subsets of those who don't vote, because of the impression that they are demotivated primarily by a possibly paradoxical combination of political apathy and political estrangement. But as you can see in the article, which we'll link, this is not statistically the case. Core idea of this article is, for those who are worried about the anti-Biden socialists not voting, and for the Biden enthusiasts worried that he may compromise his promises to get their vote, don't worry about it.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of this. I'm not even sure. Maybe I agree. Maybe I don't. Like, we talked about this last week, but there's no way that, like, the socialists who failed to turn out for Bernie are going to show up for Biden. Like, that's true.
No, it's not going to happen.
It's also not that consequential, because there's no way that those people voted for Hillary in 2016, and she only lost by a few fucking delegates, you know? What do you think, Jake? You're the, like, token Marxist.
It's a bit harder for me because I'm not American, and I say I personally, I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, but I don't vote in New Zealand election because I sort of feel that way. I don't agree that any party in New Zealand is doing anything correct. But the United States, they have a lot more to lose by doing that, and I think you have to be pragmatic in this situation.
And there's too much at stake.
Funnily enough, even though I'm not American, I converse quite often with the Democratic Socialists of America, and they really don't realize what they have to throw away. Like, from our conversation earlier in the podcast, Trump is so dangerous.
Yeah.
Some of the nuclear stuff he's doing is really geopolitically, he's a fucking terror.
Yeah.
And that's what they're voting against. So I think you can reasonably say that I'm not with Biden, but I'm against Trump.
Yeah, it's like, I don't like Biden, but there's a literal orange in the White House who does nothing.
Yeah.
Does things nothing good. Not good.
Yeah.
Nothing good.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not American.
What's it called? Jake and I were turning this article like over and over again.
We were.
Trying to say, and I wasn't even 100% sure how to conclude it, because I was like, do you agree with this?
I don't know. I also think that if you start telling all the Bernie bros that, like, oh, we don't need you and Biden can win anyway.
Yeah.
That could end up sabotaging the everything. Like, that's like the thing that changes the future for the worse, because then everyone's like, well, I might have done it if my vote would have made the difference, but if Biden's going to win anyways, then fuck it. You know?
That's what happened with Hillary.
Yeah.
An outsider's perspective anyway.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the same thing with Biden. If he says, oh, these crazy socialists, I don't want your vote, you know, you can stay angry. Nothing's good going to happen. Nothing good is going
to
happen.
Yeah. Just get Biden in office, then hold him to account, then protest him and everything, you know.
Like, yeah.
5 meter targets over 50 meter targets here, like, right? That's being strategic.
Yeah, exactly. Under Biden, they will have the opportunity to fight fairly for change the way they want to do with Bernie.
Yeah.
But in another 4 years of Trump, I don't know if they're going to have that liberty.
That's true.
Yeah.
Great. So for the second article this week, we have it coming from Ethan Paul in his article for the Quincy Institute for the Responsible Statecraft, which delves into how it is that Joe Biden could beat Trump when it comes to China and the U.S.-China relationship. Essentially, Paul points out that Biden should not set the terms of debate in the language that Trump is ultimately far more comfortable operating in, which is nationalism. Mm. He says that Biden is not adept enough to out-nationalist America's foremost nationalist and would only empower Trump to further inflame anti-Asian racism, something that has already led to a rise in hate crimes and discrimination, as you can see in, like, in the news. He recommends that Biden should instead be characteristically frank with the American people. The United States should not hide from the fact that the two countries have fundamentally conflicting interests, portending a relationship likely to get far worse and go through a number of dangerous crises in the near future. What the U.S.-China relationship needs most now is not a warrior president who relishes the fight, but rather a competent and temperate bureaucratic manager who can do the quiet, behind-the-scenes work required to build coalitions capable of bringing China to the negotiating table. If you do it like this, Paul says, any argument Trump makes about Biden's apparent weakness can be countered in a way that exposes and emphasizes the administration's incompetence and strategic bankruptcy without falling into the trap of trying to outmaneuver Trump in his own domain.
Yes. So I agreed with a lot of this piece. The big premise, too, that, like, don't accept Trump's frame. You're weak on China because you're not racist against China and because you're not a militarist. And if you respond by, like, doubling down on being dovish, then you're misreading the actual China threat. But if you respond by showing how, like, militarist you are, then you're giving the game to Trump, right? Like, you can't out-nationalist the nationalist. That was, like, the best line in there.
Yeah, it was.
And it's true. And so, like, you do have to, this is an issue set where, like, you got to turn down the volume, be technocratic. But then when you turn up the volume at all on the China issue, it's got to be to highlight Trump's strategic incompetence. And I'm concerned the Biden's campaign has not responded definitively to this so far. Like, they've offered some initial comments, but how Biden is going to address the fact that Trump is going to spend more money and more time beating the Biden is weak on China drum, that is a concern. And I don't know if Biden's campaign has positioned him optimally for that quite yet. So, like, I thought this was a good piece for the campaign to take on board. And I have to put the disclaimer out there. Several people from his campaign have solicited my CV, and okay. I have sent it in, but I am not part of his team at this point. And I mean, you guys, I'm pretty on the record about, like, how I feel.
Oh, of course.
About Biden. So,
well, that's the purpose of the podcast, right? Your personal opinions as opposed to professionally. Yeah,
that's right. And so I have to put that out there because some people know I have no intention of, like, muzzling myself or censoring myself about this stuff. But I'm also not saying anything critical. Like, it's not like I'm fucking throwing shade at Biden here. So, it's just good advice. Well,
just throwing a bit of a spanner in the works, I guess. How are you going to convince the American voter base to vote for a quiet bureaucrat that does things quietly after 4 years of Donald Trump?
I know. You have to be, like, it seems like we're in the era of celebrity politics.
We are.
Yeah.
Like, Kim Kardashian meets with Donald Trump to talk about prison reform.
That's right. Like, you need to have a million followers on Twitter in order to be viable.
Yeah.
And it's like, otherwise, it just doesn't work. That concerns me. And then, like, Joe Rogan, who's this big, he flirts with conservatives in the alt-right, but he also was, like, a fan of AOC for a while, and he says he's a socialist, but he's also a libertarian, which is, like, not possible. He's kind of all over the place because he's not intellectually sorted. He just, like, says what's on his mind, you know? But a couple days ago or last week, he said he hates Trump, but he would vote for Trump over Biden.
Dude.
Yeah.
And that's really stupid. That's really stupid. But it's also, like, an interim opinion. Like, he didn't, like, do some sound analysis and then generated that conclusion. Like, he was just speaking off the cuff. But it does worry me. You know, if I say anything more, I'll probably get in trouble. Who knows? Okay. Let's go to Ask Me Anything. All right. Time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
Okay. So the first question this week is from Anna Sutton. Why do you always say your work for Democratic presidential candidates was unpaid? Do people care if it's paid or unpaid?
Interesting, nuanced question. Yeah, people care. Or, well, some people care. I guess not everybody cares. Clearly, the questioner didn't care. There's a campaigns, especially at the presidential level, are quite large. And there's always like an inside the tent team and an outside the tent team. And the outside the tent team is kind of just like a network. And so you give your labor kind of at will or as needed. And it's, I think I talked about this before. You work on speeches, you write talking points, you answer questionnaires that newspapers send the candidates. You sort of like advocate for your candidate on social media and canvassing and stuff. You generate sometimes like background memos and strategy papers and stuff. And so like I've done all of that stuff, but it was all volunteer advisory stuff. So the label would be like, you know, volunteer foreign policy advisor or something like that.
Okay.
And that's very different from somebody who's drawing their salary from the campaign. That person lives and dies for the candidate. Like, I mean, they're like on the road sometimes. They're working 24/7 for the candidate. And it's like, I still have a day job here, you know? So there's a big difference in terms of like the hierarchy, who's on the inside of the tent and who's not. I'm in fucking New Zealand right now. Like, I'm obviously not on the inside of the tent, right? But I'm still involved. And bizarrely, I wasn't when I was in DC. So, big difference.
Is it strange for me to feel like voluntary policy advisors are a lot more trustworthy than ones that are paid? Is that...
That's interesting.
I just have that feeling, like, you know, because having that money layer adds another layer of incentive for you to not screw up and maybe not tell the truth in some cases. But if you're voluntary, you're there because you believe in it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's probably both. Like, I would say money probably does sort of conservatize you a bit, or like loyalize you. I don't know what the verb there would be, but I could see how no matter what, like I'm saying things that are occasionally critical of Biden, even though I'm backing him, and even though I may end up being an advisor to his campaign on the outside, right?
Okay.
In a million years, you couldn't do that if you're on the guy's payroll. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like there is a difference. And with me in particular, I think the main reason people listen is because like I'm not giving normal talking points from Washington, you know?
Yeah. So the second question is from Anonymous. What's your opinion about Robert Zoellick? He's got a new book coming out and has some interesting opinions about China.
Bob Zoellick was the president of the World Bank, and he was, I think he was like he was a high-level State Department guy in the George W. Bush administration. Most famously, I think he was I don't want to misstate this, I think he was a neocon, except that he wasn't very hawkish on China. The reason he's like super famous, aside from being president of the World Bank, is that he was the one who publicly stated the language that the U.S. wanted China to be a quote-unquote responsible stakeholder in the global order. And so responsible stakeholder ended up being like the key turn of phrase that everybody associated with China policy for a long time. Like, we're just trying to get China to be a responsible stakeholder, right? And that's sort of like an old position now. Like, Washington has moved on from that, or given up, I guess. And I didn't fully read it. I saw like little clips of it, but he has a book coming out about, I don't know, like America's history in the world. And he gave an interview with the American Interest, which is kind of like the national, it's just a, you know, publication. And the bits that I've seen from the interview are very critical of where Washington is on China. He's coming at it from a historical perspective and from the perspective of he's very much a neoliberal. Who's going to be in charge of the fucking World Bank and not be a neoliberal, right? So like, that's clearly his, where he's coming from, right? But I think I've talked about this before. Neoliberals have like divided views on China, because on the one hand, you can take the view that China is this like abhorrent threat to democracy and to liberal institutions. And in many senses, that's true. And that's the kind of thing that animates the kind of neocon view of China. But then on the other hand, there's like the free trade neoliberal view, where it's like absolute gains, rising tide lifts all boats. And, you know, what do you think the fucking president of World Bank's going to say? Of course. And he's the responsible stakeholder guy. Like, he wants China to buy into the international system. Mm. He's very vested in the like international financial status quo. So it's interesting to hear somebody like this who is like critiquing Washington and critiquing sort of like conservative China policy, but not from the left, from, I don't even know if it's the right, but like from the other side of the neoliberal coin, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, I'm not a fan of the dude really, but he said a bunch of stuff that I saw in the little snippets of his interview, because I need to read the whole fucking thing. But from what I saw, he said a bunch of things actually that are like very sound. China's, of course, trying to influence institutions more. Everybody does that. The US does that. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And does taking your football and going home, is that a good strategy? And it's like, obviously, it's fucking not a good strategy. So then what do we do about it? And like, things like that is very intelligent, right? That's very technocratically smart. And so I need to track this interview down, because it sounds like it's worth a read for sure. And it sounds like I agree with a lot of the stuff he says, but he's coming at it from an angle that I do not come at, because I'm not fucking neoliberal. Yeah. Also not a Marxist.
Number 13.
Just to be clear. All right, gang, that's going to do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic for the sponsor's newsletter, World Politics Review. And buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic for that COVID era money. Catch you next time. Peace.